Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast number 4. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. While capitalism continues to be the dominant economic system, which benefits we describe as innovation, wealth, and prosperity, there is a dark side. Materialism, consumerism, and the financial pressure for continuing economic growth all come with a steep price to pay, which includes enormous environmental and social justice impacts that endanger life on Earth. Our guest today, Molly Young Brown, believes that our society is in the midst of a great turning from an industrial growth society to a life-sustaining society. Molly's unique areas of study and experience have prepared her well to help guide us on the way forward to regeneration. Molly earned a master's degree in humanistic and transpersonal psychology and a master's of divinity. She has extensive training and coaching experience in psychosynthesis. Molly describes her life's work as based on living systems, which move toward integration, wholeness, learning, complexity, and self-organization. She describes human beings and all their organizations as living systems. She holds possibilities for all of us because living systems are always open to evolution, change, and adaptation. She describes herself as being steeped in psychosynthesis and in discovering the work of Joanne Macy. She found this was a logical extension of the work that she had been doing and allowed her to bring what she had learned about herself into service into the larger world. Molly sees us as all interconnected. Therefore, in the work that reconnects, she talks about honoring the pain for the world. This helps us move beyond denial and paralysis by taking action on behalf of life. Molly talks about how the great unraveling is happening because of our need to possess, control, and extract. These needs underlie the current trend toward fascism all over the world. Molly has published several books on psychosynthesis and co-authored with Joanne Macy two editions of the book, Coming Back to Life. She trains facilitators of the work that reconnects and edits the online journal, Deep Times, Journal of the Work That Reconnects. Molly describes how the Elders Action Network has taken a lead at addressing the issues of our time with the intent of leaving future generations a more loving and sustainable world by offering a doorway to elders to become empowered to make a difference. And now our hosts, John Izzo and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izzo, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, I want to welcome you to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we explore together how we can create a thriving and positive future for humanity and for the planet. And in our episodes, as you know, we explore what is the way forward. And we don't have the answers, but we hope to stimulate all of us to imagine what's possible. And, you know, before we bring on our guest today, Molly Young Brown, where we're going to explore really the issue of materialism and capitalism and how really this relates to the way forward, I couldn't help but think of the beautiful book that I know Alain and I have both read over the last year called Braiding Sweetgrass, in which the author talks about in the Native tradition in America and in Canada of focusing on gratitude and having ceremonies around gratitude and really focusing on what we have and what we're grateful for. And in it, she says that in a way, our whole economic system, the capitalist economic system, is built on the opposite, to create a sense of deficit, a sense in which we don't have enough, that we need more, that what we have is not sufficient. And she talks about the way that that not only influences our happiness, but really drives us as a society towards an unsustainable model, because we actually begin with the core idea of a system that's based on the need for people to feel they don't have what they need. So I'm excited about this conversation and dialogue today about how materialism and capitalism, which is so related to it, you know, maybe needs to change and shift if we're to find a great way forward. Alain, welcome into our conversation today.
Thank you, John. Yes, I'm very sensitive to the fact that both Joanna Macy and Molly Brown have used the terms industrial growth society as something that we need to get beyond and go to sustainable society. And so I'm really looking forward to hear Molly say a few things about that.
Same here. And hopefully we'll have a really rich conversation today and dig into some good territory.
Yeah. So let's bring Molly in. Molly, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be with you.
Yes. So I was wondering whether you would tell us a few things about your work and the lens or view that you have on a positive way forward for humanity.
Well, my work is in both the area called psychosynthesis, which I'll talk a little more about later, and the work that reconnects, which is the work that Joanna Macy has brought forward to the world. And I've had the great, great good fortune of working with her very closely and co-authoring a book with her, two versions of the same book. And so about the lens or view I have, it's based really in living systems. Mm-hmm. And living systems always move to integration, wholeness, learning, complexity, self-organization, bringing in new experiences and integrating them into a holistic response. And guess what? Human beings are living systems, as are nations, as societies, humanity as a whole. They're all living systems. So if we can just take part of the amazing intelligence and complexity and resilience of all of nature, and humans are a part of nature. So that's what gives me, it's not exactly hope, but at least the possibility that we're not completely done for.
And systems thinking has been taught for a while in the US, but not always living systems thinking.
It's been used with a very much of a, like, how do we manipulate things to make them better? Kind of attitude, rather than respectful of how living systems actually work and how they evolve and change and grow and respond to crises and so forth.
You know, one of the first things I was thinking of, Molly, just as you said that, and it is so important for us to remember that not only is the Earth a living system, we're three living systems right now. Just think of all the stuff that's going on to keep us functioning, right? And then that society and humanity, human society, is also a living system. And yet what's interesting about that is then to remember that our economic systems are in fact created systems. Therefore, we can create different systems, right? So while we're all living systems and society is a living organism, if you will, the meta systems that we have created are in fact a creation of us as organisms. So the really hopeful thing is we can recreate new, if you will, systems around how we organize as living systems. So, and that's a great reminder for us that it's not static and neither is the system that we've created. And I've often thought one of the things that gets in the way of all progress is believing that the system we have doesn't need to evolve. There's a, I think it was a Leibniz who said, we live in the best of all possible worlds. And I feel sometimes with capitalism, you know, that like one of the dysfunctional beliefs is that capitalism as we practice it is the best of all possible worlds, as opposed to maybe it's was better than, you know, authoritarian socialism, but it's not the best of all possible worlds. So how do we get curious about a different organizing system?
And I mean, change, one of the basic teachings of Buddhism is change. Change is inevitable. Nothing is going to ever not change. And that's very much a part of living systems. Are open to change. They're not static. They're always evolving and changing and adapting.
So with this in mind, then, Molly, what is psychosynthesis? Might be known to some people, but not necessarily all people. And looking through the lenses of both psychosynthesis and the work that reconnects, what are some key opportunities do you see to move back to life, which is the title of the book, Coming Back to Life, that you co-wrote with Joanna Macy, and toward a more regenerative future?
Well, those are like two big questions or three. Okay. Well, the elevator speech about psychosynthesis is that it is actually based on what actually humans actually do in as they grow and learn. They synthesize, they bring together all the parts of the psyche. And so psychosynthesis is a way of doing that more consciously, perhaps, with more attention and respect. So we can't get rid of anything. So there are parts of ourselves that we maybe don't like very much or kind of dysfunctional, but we can't just get rid of them. We can't just say, okay, I'll stop doing that. We have to integrate them, synthesize them into our whole personality. And so there's a lot of request, you know, like every part of ourselves is trying to do something for us. It may be doing it in a really dysfunctional way, but it's, you know, it's in response to experiences we've had in the past. And so we have to work with those parts and bring them into the fold, as it were, so they're no longer causing us so much difficulty. And the other thing about psychosynthesis is it has a spiritual dimension. Mm-hmm. Without defining it, without saying, okay, you have to believe this or that or the other thing, that all humans want to have a yearning for the spiritual dimension. And we have different belief systems, different religions, and so forth that speak to that. But we can't have a complete psychology if we don't include that. If we don't include our relationship to life, to Gaia, to God, whatever, however you want to say it. And that is really what attracted me to psychosynthesis. Mm. So I was steeped in psychosynthesis, and then I discovered Joanna Macy's work. And at that time, it wasn't yet called The Work That Reconnects. It was called Deep Ecology Work. But I discovered it, and it was like, to me, a logical extension of psychosynthesis, because psychosynthesis does tend to focus on the individual. And I wanted to, you know, how do I relate to the larger world? And how do I bring what I've learned about myself into service for the larger world? So the lens I look at is through a kind of a blend of those two systems. They both emphasize acceptance and expression of emotions as vital to our emotions, or feedback from the larger world and from within ourselves, that we need to pay attention to. In The Work That Reconnects, we talk about honoring the pain for the world, our grief, our fear, our anger, even our kind of numbness that we feel when we see what's happening around us. And we feel it because we're interconnected. Mm-hmm. So feelings are evidence of our interconnectedness, and we need to pay attention to them and honor them. And within psychosynthesis, the same thing happens when you're working with an individual. We need to honor those feelings and learn from them. However, humans seem to have a unique capacity to cut off feedback. I don't know if any other animal can do it. We can. We mm-hmm. can ignore it. We can repress it. We can make up stories about it. And we do this at our own peril. That's That's why we're in the mess we're in, because we haven't been paying attention to the feedback. So honoring our pain for the world helps us move beyond denial and paralysis to take action on behalf of life. I have more to say, but I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Let you respond.
Well, the question with that in mind is, what key opportunities do you see to come back to life, to go toward a more regenerative future?
The opportunities that are always there, always, always there. There's not like they've always been there and will always be there. And that is to pay attention to the feedback, to listen, to learn, to be alive, to respond, pay attention to our own feelings, and also pay attention to what's happening around us. And we can't do that with our logical, rational minds. I point to my forehead because for some reason we think that happens in here. That's what got us into this mess.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a couple of things really have struck me as we've been having this conversation. One is you used, a good connection between our own personal journey and the journey that we're all taking as a society, right? And I think that's helpful because I often think that society is actually an abstraction anyway. Society is actually simply, 7 billion or however many of us are at this given moment, individuals who are all on their own journey. And as you know, in therapy or in our own personal journey, it's so important to pay attention to what got us to the moment we're in right now, right? That's why the therapist will take us, or the healer will take us on a journey to look at our life, not because we're defined by it, but because it's our previous experiences from our early childhood, et cetera, that have shaped us. And I often think that with humanity, like I think a lot about this around materialism and around the environment, that for really thousands and thousands of years, nature was very big and humanity was very small. We really didn't impact the earth as a whole. So our main thing as children, as a species, was to conquer the earth, to overcome nature. And yet that paradigm is no longer true. So just like that child who learned things as a child that were adaptive, that now make them unable to have happiness or be effective as an adult, we've carried that paradigm of having to conquer nature over into a situation where we're the greatest force of nature now. So that in fact, our need now is to be in harmony and help nature. Now, maybe you could argue, well, that was always true, but only at the local level. At the global level, it used to be we had almost no impact on the planet, but that's no longer the world we live in. So I think there's an important connection to, just like that adult must recognize that the pattern of my childhood no longer serves me. So as a species, we must recognize that while some of how we treat nature was maybe even adaptive in our early evolution, it's actually no longer serving us. So I think there's a nice parallel to the individual psychological journey to the journey of a whole society.
I beg to differ with a couple of your points.
That's good. We like the difference. So
yes.
let's have a little debate. That would be fun.
One is that we, as a young species, wanted to conquer the earth. That's only true for part of humanity. Mm-hmm. Indigenous societies in the past and to this day, but to the extent that they've been able to maintain their traditions, weren't out to conquer the earth. They never did. They always believed that they should be in cooperation and honor the earth and its species and find ways of working with the earth. You mentioned braiding sweetgrass. I mean, that's what she's talking about in that book, is that very different. So I don't think that conquering the earth was ever a good idea. and it may have been that for a certain societies, for certain cultures, mm-hmm. that was the best they could do under the circumstance.
Yeah, and actually, Molly, I'll violently agree with you. What I really was trying to say was not so much the conquering part, wrong word. And you're right, pre-agricultural revolution, if you look at hunting and gathering tribes, which is how we were for most of our history, and I've spent time with hunting and gathering tribes still in existence in Africa, you're right, at the local level, very much it was about being in harmony with nature. What I meant, though, was that nature was always kind of like frightening and powerful. And so it wasn't so much about conquering, wrong word, but that, in other words, we always were at the mercy of nature. And then what's happened now is, while we're still at the mercy of nature, we just forgot about it. We learned to harness nature, right? And when we harness nature, we actually damaged it. And so I guess what I really probably used the word, that there was a time when we felt like that harnessing nature was helpful because nature was, you know, could be dangerous. So we could harness nature and protect ourselves from it. But in fact, we've always been in need to be in a symbiotic relationship with nature. In fact, of course, we're part of nature, which is the biggest kind of thing, is we forgot we're part of nature, not apart from nature. So actually, I agree with you. Wrong choice of word around conquering.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, a large part of Cuban society, a Western European, Western civilization, whatever you want to call it, did go in that direction, did go in conquering. And it just wasn't, everybody didn't do that.
Yes, true.
And you mentioned earlier about we each have our own journey, and that's true. And yet that journey is never independent. It's never autonomous. We're always interacting with other people and affecting other people, and they're affecting us and interacting with our environment and being affected by it. So it's a permeable boundary between what's my personal work and what's happening in the larger world.
And to some extent, the word that you've used with Joanna, the great turning, actually indicates a return or a turn toward more living systems perspective. And so looking at that, what are some of stories that you could tell us that are illustrating what this great turning is about?
Well, honestly, there's this sort of weird double thing vision that's happening to me and probably many people right now. We see all this horrible stuff going on, and we also see all this wonderful stuff going on.
Yes.
So the great turning, I think of the Sunrise Movement of among young people, Extinction Rebellion, Black Lives Matter, so many indigenous movements to protect land and water.
Yeah.
I see a rising awareness. It used to only be mostly in the United States, but now it's everywhere, about racism, colonialism, sexism, patriarchy, and our need to heal those and liberate ourselves, really liberate all of us from white supremacy. And when I say white supremacy, I'm not talking about neo-Nazis. I'm talking about the assumption that the white way is the best way. And it's not very conscious on a lot of, it's only recently become conscious on my part. And then I also want to mention the Elders Action Network as an example of work to the great turning. So it's how do we move into a world that a life sustaining society instead of a industrial growth society? How do we move into a world that works for everyone and in harmony with nature rather than exploiting and destructive of nature. So does that answer the question?
It does. And can you say a little more about how the Elders Action Network fits into that picture? What do you feel is happening there?
Well, it's the image of elderhood has been, we didn't even use the word elder. No. We use senior citizens or old folks or, what's the elder cocker or something, or some word like that. I can't remember. Anyway, and it was retirement, and we retired from work and we played golf and bridge and, and then we got sick and died. So the Elders Action Network is saying, no, wait a minute. In the first place, we have come some ways in terms of longevity, and we're healthier and longer, living longer. So I'm 80 years old and going strong. So, and in the past, 80 years old was, going to the nursing home. And still, and many people my age are still suffering from illness and so forth. But the Elders Action Network is saying, wait a minute, we have a lot of wisdom, we have a lot of experience, and we have a lot of energy, and in many cases, a fair amount of financial stability. So we can give back and share and help create a world that we leave for our children and grandchildren that's a whole lot more loving and sustainable than what we're leaving right now.
And what would, given what you just said, what would regenerative aging look like from your perspective? You say you don't use the word regeneration a lot within the word that reconnect, the work that reconnects, but what would it be, regenerative aging, from your perspective?
Well, the word regenerative says generation, creation, growth, birthing, etc. And so regeneration means doing that again at perhaps a deeper level, instead of just sort of the opposite of destroying, regenerating. And so, look at what the Elders Action Network does. There's a climate action group there, which is working on addressing the climate crisis, which we've created, I have to add. So now it's time for us to start taking some responsibility to try and change that. So regenerative aging, giving back, I guess that's the most simple way of saying it, and finding ways of using our talents and our resources in service for future generations.
Could it mean that we also continuing to grow as elders and are able to outgrow our previous worldviews and ways of looking at the world?
Absolutely. In fact, I was very active for a while in the Elder Activists for Social Justice, which is one of the teams in the Elders Action Network. Right. And the first thing we did was we spent a couple of years just educating ourselves. Uh-huh. Reading books and sharing what we've learned and creating little slideshows and things that we could. So we were learning and then passing what we were learning on to others. And that's where I really became aware of the extent of racism and in white supremacy in our culture. I didn't even know what the word white supremacy meant before I started with that group. So very much so a learning and sharing.
Molly, I wonder if we can go back to the elder conversation for a moment. And thanks for all the good work that you're doing in that realm. And as the listeners know, I've kind of been passionate for some time about, especially my particular generation, the baby boomers, who will be the oldest, longest lived, wealthiest, most highly educated group of elders in human history. And the question is, what are we going to do with that eldership? But one of the intriguing things for me is that at the individual and family level, the small tribe level, I think the vast majority of elders all around the world are already generative. And one of the interesting questions for me is what's the relationship between individualism and this issue of regenerative eldership? And let me show you where I'm going with this. For thousands of years, humans assessed their happiness by the happiness of the tribe. Individualism is a relatively recent phenomenon. Now, of course, individualism, which you could argue began in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and then America took it to another level, I would argue. And now a lot of parts of the world, especially the developed world, people define their happiness by their individual happiness. And I think there's a relationship here because a lot of elders are, in fact, very generative about their own kids, even about their local communities often, but not necessarily see a global stewardship as a part of their regenerative or generative responsibility. And I'm wondering, how do we move and take advantage of that natural generativity, which I think is there for older people with their small tribe, and move to the large tribe? I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Like, find me a grandparent who does not care about the future of their grandchildren, and I give you $100, right? Meaning find more than one out of 500 who don't care about their grandchildren, and you know, I'll give you $100, right? And so that's what I'm saying. But ask me, find 50% who are focused day to day on the generativity of the whole society, and I'm not going to bet that $100. So I'm curious how we move that natural generativity to the societal generativity.
Well, I think it's partly just doing what the Elders Action Network is doing, which is offering doorway, if you will, you know, saying, hey, an invitation. Because I think in a lot of cases, people just haven't thought about it, you know, or they feel like, oh, I couldn't make any difference anyway, so what the heck? And honestly, there is a lot of, I certainly suffer from that. You know, I look at some of the stuff that's going down and I think, I can't affect it. What can I do? So somehow empowering people and helping them realize they do, how they can have an effect. And it's not just voting. I mean, voting is like baseline, but and make informed voting too, you know, so you're studying the issues and learning how to vote most effectively. You talk about their caring about their children or their grandchildren, mostly if they're really elders, their children are grown. In fact, my children are becoming elders right now. So to be encouraging them to pay attention to what's happening in the larger world and talking with the grandchildren about the issues. I'm certainly doing that. And it's an interesting dance because when they're very young, you don't want to engender a lot of fear or anxiety in them. But as they get older, they're going to learn about it anyway. And so talking with them, sharing with them. But I'm not sure I'm answering the question.
Well, I think a couple of things you said, I think, are really important. And maybe it's not just for elders, but the invitation. So if you think about in our society, at least in the West, we don't have the traditional view of elders. People get kind of, you know, packaged out at a certain age in companies. There's a bias towards the young. And so it's like, you know, your job is to go enjoy life now and stay out of the way, right? So first, it's an invitation. And I loved you know, one of our previous guests, you know, John Sorensen, talked about when the group of grandparents went to Washington and met with the congressional people. And it was like eye-opening that people were interested in listening to them and talking to them, right? And the second thing you said that's so important is the feeling that you can change things. So it seems to me that whenever we share stories, and I'd be love to hear one from you, stories of how elders or anyone has been able to step up to change things, that's a part of the invitation, right? Because I often say it's not impotence is the biggest problem of our age, but it can't be fixed with a little blue pill. This is the impotence of the feeling that I can't change things. And, you know, we just had an election, as you know, and, you know, that one of the things that was encouraging me was how there were lineups on campuses. And I don't care who they're voting for. I mean, I do care, but meaning like in the big scheme, to me, it was very encouraging that so many young people on campuses were willing to wait in long lines, because that tells me they felt like it mattered. They didn't feel impotent, right? So I think I love your idea of the invitation. And part of the invitation are stories like John Sorensen shared of where we were able to be in the game and it did perhaps change things.
Well, I was going to say something about the impotence is also that it's based on individualism. Mm. What can I do? Mm. Well, I can't do very much. It is true. But I get together with others. If one grandmother had gone to Washington, nothing would have happened. But a whole group of grandparents went to Washington. And so the idea that we need really to work together. And even if I'm, say, writing an article in my study on my little computer and nobody else is there, when I put that article out in the world, people respond and other people get excited and they think of new things and they write stuff. And so there's always ways in which our individual effort can become amplified in relationship, in community.
And indeed, and the word modeling when it comes to elders is an important word that young people may not want to be given advice, but they can observe what elders do that is different when they are inspired, as you said, by the common good and serving the larger life.
I have been told by so many young people that they are hungry for elders.
Yes.
And by elders, I mean people that they can look up to and respect and learn from, not old folks sitting around playing bridge. Bridge is a great game, and I don't have any problem with people playing bridge, but it's kind of a stereotype.
Yeah. No, a little bit, maybe. That's good. Yeah. I haven't even heard the term bridge in a long time, I guess. But I have childhood memories of my mother playing bridge with friends, and they seem to be having a good time. So, you know, Molly, can we go back to materialism for a moment, which is where we began? I love the conversation about elders, but I know one of our core themes today, this idea of the turning and how we move from materialism. I wonder, you know, what your thoughts are on what do we need to change? How might we begin to change this whole foundation of materialism that is really at the core of so much, especially in terms of ecology, in terms of the challenges we face. So what are your thoughts about that's if we can shift to how do we move away from this materialism?
Well, for one thing, I want to define materialism as the way I'm using it or thinking about it. And it's really about human products, things that we have created. And it's about consumerism. Mm. It's, you know, I will be happy if I only have the latest iPhone or if I can just, you know, whatever. And I'm reading this fabulous book called Reclaiming the Sacred by Jeff Golden, which he really addresses this issue of, and it's incredibly researched. He's got pages and pages of documentation about studies that have been done that show, at a certain level, we need more stuff. We need food and we need shelter and we need clothing. And, you know, we need probably in our society, we need some mode of transportation. But after that, more doesn't make us any happier. I mean, we might get a little rush when we get some new thing. I certainly do. But it doesn't last. And that's not the basis of happiness. Happiness comes from love, from relationship, from creativity, from feeling like you are. It actually comes from service. We feel happy when we feel like we're making a contribution. So materialism is focused on kind of the wrong things. What do we need to, you know, be reasonably comfortable, warm, well-fed, etc.? But after that, our happiness comes from relationship, really, rather than from stuff. However, I want to make sure that when we talk about materialism, we're not talking about that, oh, we're some kind of spiritual beings and we can rise above the earth. And because I'm very, very tied to the material of the earth, that is trees and squirrels and plants and wind and rivers and mountains and valleys. And that kind of materialism is a whole different story.
And that's our connection to nature deeply.
Yeah.
I was wondering, when you talk about the great unraveling, is materialism and capitalism at the center of it from your perspective?
I think so. Yeah. It's a really interesting question because I would also add colonialism. But I'm wondering if colonialism isn't based on materialism. The whole idea that I have to possess, that I have to control and possess, which is at the basis of colonialism. And the great unraveling is happening because of that. Absolutely. So many examples, corporations, raping, destroying whole ecosystems. Mountaintop removal, dumping tops of the mountains into the valleys below in order to get to the coal that's in the ground. Tar sands extraction. I can't believe that people would actually do this stuff, and they do.
They do,
and I no doubt benefit from it. In many cases, indirectly. Then I see fascism, authoritarianism on the rise all over the world and in the United States, very, very sadly. And this election, you know, we don't know yet what the results are going to be. But so the great unraveling, white supremacy, capitalism, materialism, replacing love, community. So, yes, very much it's at the heart of it. And, you know, capitalism has been a sacred cow. It's only recently that anybody dares say, hey, maybe this isn't the best system in the world. And I get very excited when I see people critiquing capitalism. The problem with capitalism incidentally is profit. That profit is more important than anything else. What a crazy idea.
I mean, the good thing is, and you know, you talked about the great turning is, you know, as again, listeners know, I spend a lot of time in the corporate world and agree with everything that you said. Having said that, there is, I believe, a real turning happening in the corporate world in many places now. And that turning is a recognition that you can't have a sustainable business without a sustainable society. And I guess one of the biggest challenges, you know, language is really powerful. And I think we need new words for new systems, right? So, you know, socialism is not the word we should be using, because it will be forever associated with the Eastern Bloc and with the you know, really the disastrous experiment in the Soviet Union, right? We can't talk about communism, because communism will be forever tainted by the Cultural Revolution and all the things that happen in places all over the world, right? So we need to find new words, right? And I think words become powerful. And I'm hoping some people are working on some new words that might express what that new system is, because I often think the biggest barrier to change is, and you kind of hinted at this earlier, Molly, is that I think there is a great turning in terms of people realizing that what we're doing isn't working for us individually or collectively, yet we don't know what to imagine might this new system might be. So I'm hoping that, you know, we'll have to have some guests coming up here, you know, I think, Alon, you know, where we can, what is that, the new words and language, and of course, not just a language, but what's beneath that language, you know, because these words have gotten old and stale, and they're not helping us imagine a different future.
And there have been some attempts, like a benefit corporation, for instance.
Yes, yeah.
In that direction. But yes, there is much more to discover. And I'm wondering whether you could talk a little bit about the and your experience as a trainer or facilitators for the word that we connect. You know, how crucial is the balance between inner and outer work? To what extent, for instance, capitalism has had a grip on so many people because their inner work has been to some extent lacking. I'm making a big jump there, but to say, you know, we are most easy preys to capitalism and consumerism and the advertising, if indeed we haven't reflected on what are my real needs deep down.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
Yes.
And I find it difficult to even separate inner and outer work because they interact.
Indeed.
And certainly anyone engaged in activism has to kind of check their motives and assumptions. Am I doing this so I feel good about myself? Or is it really a calling from within? Yeah. And it could be both. It's not that just because it makes me feel good about myself, it's you know, ego. It could be both. But the energy obviously has to be on the calling and listening to that inner calling. You used the word imagine world. And I just want to emphasize, we can't do this with our logical thinking minds. We have to use imagination, intuition. We have to be in tune with what's happening around us in order to move forward. So, and that means inner work on ourselves, because if I'm reacting out of fear, if I'm reacting flight, fright, freeze, and now they've added fawn to it too, which I think is great. In other words, when you go, oh, please, please like me, I'm okay. You know, that would be fawning. And these are all, I mean, they're hardwired. When we really feel threatened, it's really hard not to go into fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. Mm-hmm. So that's where the inner work has to be done, so that whatever traumas I have in the past that might get triggered and cause me to go into that mode of response. So we need imagination and intuition to sense our way forward. You're talking about the way forward. There isn't the way in the first place, as you know, but we have to sense it. It's more of a sense than a thought. Personal work is just essential to being of service to the world. And I'll just put in a plug, psychosynthesis really does that.
Yes.
I wrote a book called Growing Whole, Self-Realization for the Great Turning, which addresses that very specifically. what's the work we need to do on ourselves in order to be of service to the world.
Yes. And you were emphasizing the importance of feelings and therefore the heart,
mm-hmm.
and the capacity to indeed not always subject the heart to the mind. The mind tends to divide, as we know. So how could you give us maybe an example of what do you invite your facilitators or the people that you train to develop that dimension of themselves, that the heart intelligence and the spiritual intelligence, mm. they both sometimes go together.
They certainly do go together. I don't know the difference, frankly. And I think about some of the work that's being done in neuroscience,
mm-hmm.
where they're discovering that there's as many nerve cells in the heart as there are in the brain. And there's also a gut brain. So that, and the heart seems to be more in tune to the greater whole, the good of the greater whole. And the thinking mind tends to be more like, how do I get from A to B?
Right.
So it's very useful. We certainly need our thinking minds. I don't want to, I really like my little brain, but it needs to be in service to the heart, mm-hmm. in service to the good of the greater whole. And yeah.
You know, Molly, it does kind of totally agree, by the way, and our time will be running short here soon. But, you know, one of the, I totally agree about the inner work must precede the outer work. We can't really transform outside unless we transform inside. It raises an interesting question. Is there a way for society to do inner work? And I don't have an answer in mind, but I think it's a really important question, right? Because we have lots of, you know, through the spiritual and the psychological traditions, lots of practice doing individual inner work, but especially in modern society, we have no practice or paradigms for doing inner work as a society. And I'll just start the conversation by saying, it seems to me that the first piece is for us to even convene to have conversations about the inner life of the whole society. David Suzuki, the environmentalist, and I at one time, we're both, you know, living in Canada, me part of the time, him all the time. One time he had talked about the natives used to have these chautauquas where they would bring together, you know, people often from different tribes and just have these big, like, days-long conversations. And we had talked about what if we had a national conversation in Canada where we just, instead of coming with the answer to promote an idea, could we get people having a conversations, a chautauqua? And I'm wondering what your thoughts are. How do we begin to have the inner conversation as a tribe? And here I mean as a global tribe, a local tribe, that might mirror the inner conversation we have to have. Any thoughts on that? Do you agree with me? We need to do that.
And how
do we do it? Yeah.
I've thought of a couple of things. One is, I think to the extent that it's been done and more or less effectively, the Truth and Reconciliation that took place in South Africa and has been used in other countries. Mm-hmm. I believe it's happening in Colombia right now.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly is along those lines. And I felt for such a long time that we need that in the United States. We mm-hmm. need to have a Truth and Reconciliation about the genocide of Native peoples and the enslavement of Africans and on and on. Those are just two of the most dramatic mm-hmm. sins that our nation has gone through. So, and in fact, right now that I think it is happening. I think there's a lot of books being written and a lot of examination going on, especially around racism in the United States. And that's why there's so much reaction against it, because it's working.
Right. And,
so we have, you know, critical race theory. Oh my God. Oh. You know, so there is a reaction to it, but nevertheless, it is going on. And I see, the inner work, I think, is happening. And honestly, I think the Elders Action Network is one of the places where it's taking place.
So we like to end with a more personal question. I mean, they are personal questions that we've asked, but how do you personally try to live a more regenerative life?
Well, it's interesting. I didn't take any notes on that question because I was thinking, Well, one thing that comes to mind is certainly paying attention to how I spend my money.
Of course.
It's not just, do I want this thing, but also what's the impact of this thing on the larger whole. So for example, I'm trying to reduce my use of plastics. I haven't been able to eliminate it at all. But if I have a choice between something in a glass and something in plastic, I'll buy the glass, even if it costs a little more. So just constantly being aware that my actions are having an effect on the larger whole. And I think a lot of people don't have that awareness at all. I want it. It's going to fill my felt sense of need. So I'm going to get it if I can afford it. And for a long time, we were very low income. We're still relatively low income, but we were quite low income for some years. And so I didn't buy stuff because I couldn't afford it. Now I can afford it, but I'm still saying, wait a minute. So as much as, I don't know if that's part of regenerative, but
it is. It is.
It feels like it's important. You know, do no harm. The basic medical pledge, do no harm. Mm-hmm. And I think it's impossible not to do harm in today's world, but at least I try and limit it. And sharing.
Well, your modeling with the people that you train is an essential part of regenerative living too, isn't it?
Yeah, the sharing. Yeah, sharing. Go ahead.
So first of all, Molly Young Brown, thank you. You are indeed young at heart, a young soul and an old soul together. So we thank you for your work. We thank you for this conversation today. And also, you know, encourage people to go out and get your book, which we'll put on our podcast site so people can get that. So I want to thank Alain Gauthier, Jim Burke, our producer, and thank you, of course, for listening to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast. We would love to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Give us your feedback. We certainly would love you to share this podcast with others if it's added value to you. And please suggest other great guests that we might have come join our conversation. Mm-hmm. So for now, we want to thank you for joining us. And remember, as Molly said, each one of us in a small way can create the future we want. I always tell people the world can't change because of you, but it probably can't change without you. So, and Alain, any final comment from you?
No, I was delighted that we were able to explore these various dimensions. And I really want to use the word model again. You model the way that elders could be at this time. Thank you.
Excellent. So thank you again. And we look forward to seeing you again next time.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Elders Action Network. Their website is eldersaction.org. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast on Podbeam.